Welcome to the Critical Futures Podcast. It's critical because the time is now to conjure the world and communities we want to live and thrive in. But it's also futurity, or the intentional imagining and materializing of liberated futures where freedom from oppression, trauma, violence, and discrimination are realized. In this series, we chat with members of the Anti-Racism Consortium in partnership with the Institute for Healing Justice and Equity. These are conversations between organizations and their community partners to highlight how to deeply work with community in a way that shares power and moves us all towards liberation.
All right. Thank you all for joining us to the Critical Futures Podcast. I am Keon Gilbert, one of the co-directors of the Institute for Healing Justice, and I welcome you all to the Critical Futures Podcast. If you all wouldn't mind taking a quick second to introduce yourself and who you're, what organization you're representing, and we'll jump into some conversation about critical futures.
Aloha, my name is Nikos Leverins. I am the Grants and Advancement Manager with Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center. The mission of Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center is to reduce harm, promote health, create wellness, and fight stigma in Hawaii and the Pacific. We provide a variety of services, including syringe exchange across the state to curb HIV, homelessness services here on Oahu, medical case management services for people living with HIV on Oahu, transgender services here on Oahu, and to a lesser extent across the islands. So happy to be here. Thank you.
Vilina Maikako, Oahu no o Kili'i a Bordo, no Hawaii Mayel, Ikapai Aina o Hawaii Kamoku o Oahu. Aloha everyone, my name is Kili'i a Bordo. I come from Hawaii, the island of Oahu. I am one of two HIV program managers that supervise our medical case management team in the field of HIV. I also co-facilitate a Native Hawaiian program within our HIV program called Ke Olopono that uses case management without walls in the field during cultural activities. Mahalo for having us.
Aloha. My name is Madeline Sisipasara, but you can call me Maddie. I also work at Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center, where I run our transgender program, which is called Ko'ana Project. And this is also my community. So it's for trans by trans. So all trans women work in this department for our community. So thank you for having me here.
Anoa'i ke aloha kako. I'm Kekua ke aloha. I am the other HIV program manager. I come to the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center from Kumukahi Health and Wellness on Hawaii Island. And so I have experience providing HIV medical case management in both the rural setting and an urban setting. And I'm really passionate about really reducing the barriers that exist for people in rural communities, especially those who are Kanaka Maoli or Native Hawaiian. So I'm very excited to be here to talk about this, and mahalo for having me.
Thank you all for joining us for this conversation about health equity, anti-racism, and anti-racist health policy. So I'll just jump in with a question, and you all can, you know, toss the question around or go around however you please. So the title of this series of podcasts is called Critical Futures. And when you think about this idea of critical futures, what does it mean for your work around anti-racist health policy and or research? Or even some of the programs and services that you offer.
So I think what critical futures mean to me is assuring that our Native Hawaiian community get a piece of that pie, right? Not being left behind, not being forgotten about, but really intentionally looking for funding that is specific for our community. And even if it's not specific for our community, if it's in the peripherals and if I can bring that to my community, I think that's something that needs to happen. Because as we, being in the medical field, I understand like the inherent racism that is within the medical field, and not only within the medical field, but within the insurances that cover those services. So I want to make sure that that access is still available to my community, if not directly through the actions and the of our program, of our agency, just assuring that Native Hawaiians are intentionally taken care of and have access.
I would also say, yeah, for making sure that, you know, our trans community is also getting a piece of that pie, because trans folks have, been experiencing injustices for decades, and understanding that we deserve a piece of that pie and making sure that we're not left out and, making sure our people are taken care of and making sure that policymakers, healthcare providers are doing our people right. Here in Hawaii especially, we know as LGBT folks, we have a place here in Hawaii. We have a place at the table. We know who we are. We're Aikane, which refers to our lesbian and gay brothers and sisters. Mahu refers to our transgender and non-binary folks and people who, for those folks, and it wasn't until the Westerners came and they turned such respected names into such horrible, into a horrible word that was respected and trying to reclaim that. And so, critical futures is something that is definitely needed, and hopefully it can be utilized for everyone, I guess,
I think when I hear the phrase critical future, and I think about the provision of healthcare here in the Aloha State, we really have to go back to, our history and the continued dispossession of our Native Hawaiian population. And Maddie just made reference to how, the trans community has been marginalized. Mahu meant something very different in Native Hawaiian culture than it meant up through about maybe a decade ago. It was transformed from a term that of relative reverence and respect. Mahu, were caretakers of the community. They named children. They provided, ceremony. They were keepers of knowledge. And here they were treated, like trash, in westernized Hawaii. That goes back to the dominance of Protestant sectarianism. So understanding that, I think there also has to be a commitment to continually look at, and collect good data regarding health outcomes. The data we have show that, our Native Hawaiian population and our migrant Pacific Islander and Asian communities face significant, systemic health disparities across the board. And it was particularly magnified during the COVID-19 pandemic, where you had the Micronesian community writ large kind of sealed off from the healthcare system entirely, because that's the way Congress wanted it for a certain amount of time. So they were amongst the most impacted by COVID in our state. You also had the Filipino American community, very much impacted, because they are the principal service workers in our state now. The community, the Filipino American community, really had to mobilize once they were given resources with groups like Philcom Cares that kind of met people where they're at. We also have to talk about, the continued criminalization of poverty and behavioral health issues in Hawaii and elsewhere. And the whole scope of our criminal legal system here in Hawaii, has Native Hawaiian people in its crosshairs. And it's been that way since territorial days. At every stage of the process, from surveillance through arrest, through imprisonment, to reentry and supervision, Native Hawaiians are disproportionately impacted. And we also have Pacific Islander migrants who suffer the same treatment. Micronesian, we have the highest rates of criminalization of school children in Hawaii, according to a UH study. That is not a happenstance. This is how structures of power operate to marginalize and dispossess people of color here in Hawaii. So sorry for getting on the soapbox there, but if I'm given it, I'm going to use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikos, for talking about the disproportionately impacted communities, because what comes to mind for me when I hear that very, very recent example, right? Our Filipino, the Filipino community was disproportionately impacted by the Lahaina fires, you know, in addition to a lot of other marginalized communities, but a really large proportion of them were Filipino. And when I think about situations like the fires in Lahaina, which is the direct result of colonial impact here in Hawaii, we think we see the way that all these power structures kind of interface and how they're upheld and how they're consistently reinforced. So, for example, Maui has had a long history of water rights struggles because native farmers are trying to secure water rights to their lands. And the water gets diverted to feed tourist attractions, to give hotels water. And so we end up with places like Lahaina being an arid desert, practically, which is just, I mean, it's like a matchbox when you have these high winds and something just sparking it. And so now the narrative is coming out that, you know, it's the native Hawaiians who are fighting for water rights that are the reason that the fires got so bad. And so the ability for people in power to shape these narratives about our communities is really dangerous and wielded in really terrible ways. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
So I want to ask a question, and you all have already started to answer one of the questions that I have about pressing issues, populations, and you've even started to touch on not only the intersections of various identities, but the intersections of health inequities and the environment and different groups that are advocating for change. One of the questions that I have as a person who, one, has not visited Hawaii, but recognizes some of the many challenges and health and social issues that occur there, just because I'm in, you know, public health and study health equity more broadly, what do you think is preventing this conversation from happening on, quote unquote, the mainland?
I think what prevents this conversation from happening in the continental U.S., well, specifically about Hawaii and our population, is that we're not considered significant. In the HIV field, and this is something that's been a problem for a long time, we are not accurately represented in data. We are aggregated with other Pacific Islanders, and so there's no accurate way for us to get a true snapshot of what our community's actual data is. And we are often told that our numbers are so significant, right? Insignificant, that we were just grouped together as the other. And so for a long time, we were the other. And just being able to make our voices heard has been, I mean, just incredible work. I really mahalo the people who came before us, because I wasn't a part of that group, right? I'm thinking of people like Auntie Carolyn Kuali'i, Carol Makai Nai, people like that who were vocal about the things that we needed and didn't let people brush us aside. And so I think we just need to continue that legacy of advocacy, that we need to be loud and willing to use our voices whenever the opportunity presents itself, and even when it doesn't.
I think getting people to share their personal stories is profoundly impactful. And we have electronic media now. We have YouTube, TikTok, all the other social media platforms where we can be visible and make the invisible visible. For far too long, Asian Americans, you know, all in all of the subsets they're in, Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders and all of the subsets they're in, we all have our unique experiences and our unique challenges. For example, as a gay person, you know, third generation, I guess, Filipino immigrant on one side, white on another side, and I have relative privilege given socioeconomic status, background, you know, profession and all of that. My story is going to be a lot different than somebody who doesn't have that, or, you know, say, you know, a Micronesian who comes over and, you know, is in a totally alien, you know, quite literally alien landscape. So the challenge, you know, our legislature here declared, you know, racism a public health crisis again before the pandemic. So there has to be always a look toward, you know, how are we serving, you know, the immigrant communities? How are we serving the migrant communities in an effective and compassionate way that responds to their needs? Language access is a huge issue here in Hawaii, huge. It's shocking to me. I had lived in California for 2.5 decades, and coming here and finding out that, you know, people who speak, you know, Asian languages have difficulty accessing language access services. It just blows my mind. So if we're talking about racism as a public health crisis, language access is sort of the bare minimum that needs to be done, because it's how people interface with healthcare systems. And I'll just leave it at that for right now.
I did want to just touch upon why I feel like this conversation isn't happening on the continent. Unfortunately, I think we've fallen into the dichotomy of a hierarchy system when it comes to minorities and who gets services, who gets access. And like Kikuo was mentioning before, you know, it really came to light in our national HIV conference, where the Native folks, not only Native Hawaiians, but the American Indians and the Alaska Natives, were kind of shuffled around within our community panels, kind of shuffled around within the larger NMAC system, just different staff shuffling around different staff, and just making the coordination of the event possible, to the point where our Native Hawaiian CAP had to really separate from the larger NMAC conglomerate, and really create our own program and create our own intention. And then when we followed up with the Native Americans and the Alaska Natives, they had similar experiences, being shuffled around from staff to staff, not really having a set person to help them coordinate these things. This is the second year that that's happened to our Native folks. And I see that as becoming a trend. So I feel like we try to make things tighter and a little bit more accessible in Hawaii, because when we go to the continent, we're forgotten about.
So just as a quick follow-up, you were talking about shuffling around within the healthcare system, or are you talking about
within the conference?
Within the conference itself.
Yeah, it was a national conference.
Okay, and NMAC stands for?
AIDS Council, sorry. National Minority AIDS Council.
I just wanted to make sure I had that clear for those of us who may not know what that conference is. And so, actually, this sort of raises a question for me that came up in one of your previous comments about resources. You talked about the lack of resources, or resources not reaching Hawaii. What has been the significant gap in resource allocation, or even access to different types of resources?
It's really within the coverage of insurance. So we see, you know, we see that the largest kind of community that needs access to behavioral health services are our homeless community, are our people that are experiencing poverty. And those folks can only get on the Quest systems, you know, the state benefits. Yet none of the providers take that state benefit. So the exact community that needs this benefit isn't able to access it because it isn't in their coverage plan, because they don't pay for their insurance. It's a state benefit. And it's probably the bigger, and like I stated before, you know, the whole medical system as a whole being a barrier. And it's those providers that don't accept the state benefit that caused that barrier and that caused the inaccessibility for those much needed services for these communities.
And other gaps in funding outside of insurance or for other programs, services, even research dollars?
I think we try to close the gaps with our other funding. So for instance, we have Ryan White funding for our HIV program, and then we have separate DOH funding, Department of Health funding, state funding. We utilize that state funding to affect or to create programs for our Native Hawaiian communities, because the state recognizes that Native Hawaiians are one of the risk populations alongside women of childbearing years and our youth. So those were communities that were identified as high risk of not being successful in HIV care. So then we subvert our other funding to create these spaces specifically for our Native Hawaiians where they wouldn't have had this otherwise.
And to kind of tack on to that, right? So the situation with funding and access to resources becomes a very different conversation when you're talking about different islands. So when you're on Oahu and you're in Honolulu, there, so coming here from the Big Island, which is the island of Hawaii, very rural, about 4,000 square miles. I mean, it's the amount of resources that we had to work with there were very limited. So when I came to Honolulu, I felt like there was so much more. And there is, you know, there is a lot more, but the population density here is so much higher that no matter how much more it seemed like there was here, it's still not enough. But when they're talking about rural communities, like on the Big Island of Hawaii or even like in Maui County. So Maui County has four islands in it and they have one AIDS service organization. And so they have to do outreach, not just on Maui, but on Molokai and Lanai also, where there are other smaller communities. And so like agencies like that who spend money just traveling to places, you know, you have less available for other things that you might need it for. And so like, for example, on the Big Island, you know, we drove a lot. Like we would spend an entire day going to one part of the island to do outreach. And we would spend another day going to an entire another part of the island just to do outreach. And so just the amount of time that goes into that is just, it's a significant investment that people don't necessarily consider. And so like, it's a little bit easier if you have the ability to send someone on a Lyft or an Uber, or to get on a bus. But rural communities don't have that. And it's just, you're at the mercy of the infrastructure of the county that you live in.
That is truly fascinating to think about infrastructure, to think about land and geography very differently. And the interesting challenges that you have within an island and across islands. And it's something that, you know, I doubt many of us really sort of think about in that way. And unfortunately, on the continental U.S., we only think urban and rural and sort of ignore kind of what's in between and all sort of the various pieces and parts that separate urban and rural environments. And this really helps to highlight that in a lot of different ways. And I appreciate you sharing that.
Oh, and I want to throw in, too, the Federated States of Micronesia. So I've never been there, but Uncle Johnny, oh, he passed away. He rests his soul. But he shared at a conference once about how they had to do outreach in the Federated States of Micronesia. It's like around Chuuk area. And they would have to get in a boat with a little motor and go from island to island and hop out in the water to go, you know, take testing to the communities on these smaller islands. And the incentives they use, because, you know, we're used to incentives like a gas gift card or something like that to draw people in. They used apples. Like that was their incentive for their patients, you know. And when I hear about struggles like that, it puts everything into perspective for us. It makes me feel grateful, but not to like minimize our challenges because they are significant. But also to elevate, you know, the stories of people who are doing the same work with much more limited resources and still managing to get it done.
That's a great segue to talking about ways to partner with communities. And if you could share some examples about partnerships, and I'll ask a couple of follow-up questions from there. So how do you partner with community? How do you approach building partnerships and relationships?
For us, I think we really utilize gatekeepers of our community. We try to partner with different agencies that also that provide, well, for me, being a co-facilitator of our Native Hawaiian program, it's finding those connections with other agencies providing Native Hawaiian services that might have Native Hawaiian funding, and really getting into those groups, those cohorts, to kind of discuss ideas and what works, what doesn't work, and then really creating something and moving that forward. I think being mindful that there are people attached to this data is really important, because a lot of times our people are just used for numbers, and then nothing else ever happens. So we never want to fall into that system of thinking that we can just count people and then let them. We really want to be intentional in providing that access.
Yeah, and I think with our trans community is the same thing. You know, we're able to mobilize, especially our trans leaders on different islands. Being what Keikoa said earlier about how it's different on different islands. So making sure that we're able to have these meetings and have these discussions of what's going on different islands with our trans folks. So working with, you know, like Kumukahi, where is that it? Kumukahi, Maui AIDS, Malama Pono, getting their leaders on those islands involved. And also, you know, because of limited access, limited services for trans folks, you know, it's traumatizing when, especially when a gender affirming care agency closes, like Lavender Clinic, you know, it puts us in a bind. And so, you know, by making sure we're able to collaborate with other agencies, other healthcare providers, because it's limited for trans folks. And, you know, and then we're overwhelming these providers, you know, and it's not fair. So, you know, working with our Congress folks, you know, our legislators, putting policies in place is so important to making sure that, you know, our trans folks are not being left behind, you know, because it's a struggle. It's an ongoing struggle for our trans folks who are accessing healthcare, accessing housing. You know, our elders in care homes are being discriminated or misgendered. So, you know, making sure we're able to mobilize with other folks to make sure that all our people are being provided with the proper care, because everyone deserves that, especially our trans folks. You know, we've been, you know, like I said, our injustices have been for decades, and it's enough already. And so I'm working with, you know, and also providing trainings for those that want to do better for our trans folks and all of that. So I just wanted to add what Kenny said again. Thank you.
And I think a hallmark of the agency that we work for, as well as the other aid service organizations, is that we hire from the community.
Yes.
You know, we serve people who are actively using substances, people who are having high-risk sexual behaviors, people who are living on the streets, because we have people working here who have lived through that. And so that is such a big strength of us and the agency that we work for, and just believing that the lived experience is so valuable. So when you have people with the lived experience who are now service providers, we can advocate and we can speak from a really personal level. And that the ability to do that is just, it's unparalleled.
Amen. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for saying that, Keikoa, because I come from, you know, from the streets. I don't have a college degree or anything like that. You know, I'm lived experience. And so I'm very passionate when it comes to my community because of what I went through. You know, I don't want any of our youths going through that. It's sad what's going on the continent. And I'm glad we live in a blue state, but does that mean that we're fine? No. It puts our community in anxiety. You know, we're afraid if this will happen to us, you know. But so making sure we're aligned with our legislators, you know, with our trans leaders, mobilizing community members, getting folks that want to be our allies. But, you know, it, when it comes to allies, we don't want you just standing with us. Stand with us when we're not in the room. Take the hits, take the beatings for our trans folks. But trans folks are tired of being hurt. We're tired of it. You know, it's traumatizing to us. So, you know, by getting folks involved is so important. And we thank, you know, Department of Health. We thank, you know, our champions at the legislature levels. You know, we thank especially our agency. You know, that's why I love where I work, because if it wasn't for them, I don't think I'll be working here, because they allow us to do what we need to do for our people, especially our community, you know. So.
Great, Maddie. Mahalo. I just wanted to really briefly talk about, you know, our partnerships and having continued conversations around policy. For example, I'm a participant in the advocacy group for Partners in Care, which is a group of homelessness services providers across the island of Oahu. The neighbor islands have their own called Bridging the Gap. And one thing that we're interested in is, you know, creating a better regulatory framework so that people can access not just emergency shelter or temporary housing, but hopefully the end goal is to secure permanent supportive housing. We're also working a little bit in homelessness prevention. Another great partnership that was recently launched was the True Cost Coalition, that's spearheaded by the Hawaii Association of Nonprofit Organizations, where we have services contracts that have fixed costs, sometimes for several years, 4, 5, and beyond sometimes, while rents, cost of living, you know, just the expenses increase. For example, our syringe exchange services contract, really, it's been stuck at $660,000 plus for basically 20 years. And this is something that, you know, we need to think about in concert with other service providers in delivering effective services to already underserved populations. So my view is, and I'm not alone in this, is that austerity is a political choice. So we need to make it very clear to our policymakers that, you know, we're operating on the margins here and we cannot, you know, sustain adequate services for underserved and under-resourced communities without, you know, a concomitant commitment from the public sector.
This has been beyond fascinating and interesting. And I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions. One is about sort of the role of gatekeepers. And so you talked about gatekeepers as being individuals who can help you gain entree into communities, trusted individuals. And, you know, I often, when I talk to people about gatekeepers, I often, you know, sort of raise a couple of questions about them. One, who they are, what are the roles, and then also identifying the unique gates that they keep. And so I'm interested in you maybe sort of walking through that a little bit, because often when people think about community engagement, we encourage people, identify leaders, identify those who are the trusted individuals in communities, but we also have to recognize that not everyone is trusted by everybody as well. And so maybe we could explore some of that.
I know for me, and working with the Native Hawaiian community, it's really engaging with our cultural practitioners, because they are the key to the community. And also, not only the community, but the community that I would like to build and flourish, is really bringing cultural pride back into our Native Hawaiian community. Because for a long time, it was, you know, I mean, outlawed to speak the language. And then, you know, you're kind of seen as a less than, or that's how you think of yourself. Because you don't see yourself represented, right? In any media, in any healthcare, you just don't see yourself represented. So you don't think those things are for you. So I just want to bring back that cultural pride. And that's usually where I start, is cultural practitioners, you know, our our kumuhula, our dance teachers, our lua providers, our warriors, even our craft makers, you know, people that carve things out of stone, out of wood, just using their expertise and their community to kind of drive my intention forward.
For Ko'ana, well, for me personally, as a trans woman that's been doing advocacy work since something, what is that for us gatekeepers, for trans folks, was the queen mothers. You know, we did a lot of, we used them because these queen mothers had like 15 to 30 kids. You know, it made sense for us to work with these queen mothers, these queen fathers, and really explaining what their roles would be. And, you know, we just needed them to get the girls in. And it worked, you know, by collaborating. You know, my mother queen, God bless her soul, Kawi Famuina, she was a big gatekeeper in our community. And, you know, she's very vocal. She was very out there. And it, for us, that was the perfect person. And then I didn't realize I was a gatekeeper when I joined Utopia Hawaii in 98, you know, as invited to a party. And, you know, they were telling me, and then when I went to that party, it was actually an HIV 101. And then there was some kava afterwards, and there was some mixing and mingle. And for us, it was like, by getting these gatekeepers there, they're the ones that's telling their children or their family, come check this out, come utilize this service. Oh, they have this for trans folks. For trans folks, it was like, oh my gosh, I never knew we could learn about HIV 101 and have a party at the same time and drink some kava and kiki at the same time. So by us utilizing these gatekeepers and making things fun, it was a way of us capturing those numbers and getting our clients in to get the services that they deserve. So for us, gatekeepers is a number one way of us making sure that our program gets the data or the numbers that they need. But more importantly, just to make sure our people are getting services that they deserve. So I don't know if that made sense, but that's how we utilize our gatekeepers.
That made perfect sense. Yeah, thank you. I mean, and, you know, the idea of using house culture as a way of reaching folks who may not sort of think about, you know, or struggle with accessing services in all kinds of ways. And as you mentioned, making it fun and exciting as a way of sort of framing, you know, the importance of health. Makes a really, really, really big difference, I think. Actually, I want to ask you another follow-up question about, you know, you talked about your lived experience and now being in this role of becoming not only a gatekeeper, but an advocate in lots of different ways. So I would, you know, if you want to share a little bit more about sort of the things that you did to help prepare yourself to, you know, be in the role that, or take on the various roles that you've had. Since I won't say the year, but you know.
Well, okay. So for me, when I found myself, it all started with a drag family. You know, my birth family, they all supported me, but I was missing more, or, you know, I didn't feel like I was at my true self. And I got that from my drag family. And they were the ones that taught me about gender affirming surgeries, gender-affirming care, about hormone therapy, and all of this. I got that from them. I didn't get that from my birth family that accepted me. And that's rare for someone that came out in the early 90s. Normally, anyone that comes out, all my friends got thrown out of their house. They were living on the streets. So I started seeing them thrive for me, thriving was they're looking softer. They're looking so much feminine. And I'm like, you know, my family accepted me. How come I don't look as good as they do? And by joining a drag family, you know, well, I didn't join it. Howie just said, "You're my daughter," and I became. That's how I became her child and got into this family. And they were the ones that showed me all of this. And if it wasn't for my drag family, I honestly wouldn't think I would be as beautiful as I am today. But by getting that support, that's how I found myself. And even going to, you know, even when it came to hormone therapy, I thought I could just go to a doctor and get that. I was so madly mistaken when I walked into Kaiser Permanente at the time. You know, I love them now, but I hated them back then. They wouldn't even address me by my proper name. You know what I mean? So I had to go to a black market doctor pretty much and go get hormone therapy where all the girls are going to get their shots. And you know what I mean? And that's how I pretty much learned that's how I learned my street smarts. That's how I learned to be a trans woman, an empowered trans woman. This is, you know, it was through my drag family and the support of my family. But, you know, if it wasn't for my drag family, I don't think I would be as successful as I am today or even motivated to even be in this field. So did that make sense? I felt like I was jumping all over the place.
No, it's helpful for talking about your, you know, you taking on these other roles now with, you know, thinking about HIV prevention, talking about health equity, talking about the intersections of social, various social identities. And so it seems like that helped to prepare you for what you're doing now. And so, you know.
Yeah, because for me, it's like making sure that I'm comfortable in my own skin. And today I am now. I still feel I need a little bit touches up here and there, but, you know, I'm comfortable in my skin. But back then, I was not comfortable in my skin. I didn't like going out in public. I didn't even like trying on girls' clothes. I would make my trans sister go try on the clothes for me, and then I would take it home and put it on. That's how insecure I was about myself, because I was such a people pleaser that I wanted to make my parents proud, you know, and that's just how I was. Like, I didn't come out to my parents till 92. You know, and this is something that I've been wanting to do since I was, 12 years old or even younger, you know. So I thank my drag family because they were the ones that would really help me.
Well, how are you all helping to sort of build a cadre or build a cohort of other community-based leaders to join the fight, to join in the work, to help expand the work?
Well, I know for us at Kuana Project, that's why we have Ka'aha Mahu, where we build leaders. We know here in Kuana Project, we know we can't do the work alone. And it is so important for us to build leaders. So having this group where we're able to, you know, talk about everything when it comes to policy, when it comes to discrimination, we bring that all up. And this is a group that we encourage folks that we feel that has the potential to be a leader that or is a leader. And we're inviting them to these groups because we need more of us to do this work. Because if I die tomorrow, the work still needs to continue on, you know, the next day and the next day, as one of my former supervisors says, the work still needs to continue. So, you know, by having this group, by also starting up our own, you know, gender affirming care facility here at HHRC, that's in the works. So, you know, all these, those are some ways, and just making sure that we're able, for Kuana, maybe making sure that we're able to continue working with our legislators that are our champions and making sure putting in policies in place. And thank God we have Nikos because he's so akamai when it comes to policies and stuff. You know, I'm still a baby at it. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get to talking a little bit more about policy. And I'm curious, others' thoughts about, you know, really, you know, what you've described in terms of succession planning, and maybe that's not the right word or phrase, but the idea that, you know, we need to make sure that there are more involved in work and thinking about how do you add to the base of champions for this work. Any others want to share? And I should have mentioned that we should have all felt free to, you know, if the listeners could have seen our responses and reactions to part of your story. It would have been far better. There were snaps. There were lots of head nods. So unfortunately, I have to describe it because I can't see it. But I want to also just thank you so much for sharing so much of your personal story too.
Yeah, I think for me, what comes to mind when we're talking about engaging communities and, you know, bringing more champions to the table, is really not looking at the obvious. You know, we have a bunch of service providers who are doing, you know, like we all have our little niche, right? We all have our little area that we focus on that we're all really good at. And so there's no need for us to like necessarily diversify because then we can't specialize, right? But if we have people in multiple specialties from different service providers already represented, then who are we really missing? We're missing the community. And so the community is what we need to bring to the table more than anybody else, right? Who is being served by these policies, by our healthcare systems? Because if they're not represented, then why are we there? Why are we meeting? You know, I love, like, so there's a local organization, the Imperial Sovereign Court of Hawaii, and they provide like micro grants for people living with HIV. And they are not, I mean, they are a 501c3 nonprofit, but they are very like local. They have their bylaws, but they are very relaxed. And it's a family type of atmosphere and people who just got together because they cared about their community. And so I get really moved when I think about organizations like that, because that's the backbone of all of this. They were part of the starting of the Life Foundation, which eventually became, you know, H3RC. They pick up the slack where our funding can't help. You know, they were able to help us get baby supplies or baby items for a client of ours who just had twins, you know? And so it was being able to turn to people like that who come from the community and care about the community and will do what they can to take care of that community. That's a really special thing. And so when we engage community just in general and people who are affected, and people who just generally care, that's, to me, that's where the magic happens.
If I could just add very briefly, I think, you know, it's critically important. You know, we here at H2RC, you know, we provide services, you know, with an open hand, you know, an open heart and also open ears. In the context of our syringe exchange program, we're continually receiving feedback on what people, you know, on the streets need at any given point in time. So, for example, I helped procure grant funding from the Comer Family Foundation to purchase fentanyl test strips pre-pandemic. This was before it was considered drug paraphernalia, and that necessitated, you know, a law being passed and signed last year. But just basic survival, our syringe exchange program has also provided naloxone to people, first injectable and then Narcan, the nasal spray. We've been doing that since at least 2016, if not probably a bit earlier. So meeting and taking feedback, it's part of our syringe exchange law, you know, to continually receive, you know, feedback from folks on the ground. Institutions need to also be flexible. This pandemic saw our agency grow by quite a bit. We took on our homelessness services contract during that time. We fought with, you know, the prospect of our aid services funding being cut. Fortunately, that was a very short legislative battle. But we also met the needs of the larger community in working with state and local officials to manage the isolation facility in Waikiki. We also helped deliver, we partnered with the Hawaii Food Bank to deliver over 1 million pounds of food. And that's something that we were doing before the pandemic, and that's something we're continuing to do today. So just always leave room for listening to the needs of the community and finding what the most appropriate response is at any given point in time.
And definitely planting seeds where you can. Not intentionally, but I think it's because of my excitement. I bring it up everywhere that I'm trying to rebuild this Native Hawaiian program and be culturally sensitive and culturally aware. But I think my excitement gets the best of me and I bring it up everywhere, but that brings in support for me. Like I've gotten, you know, support from our state HIV coordinator who wants to help because the numbers of HIV or hepatitis running through our Native Hawaiian community is still quite high. So I have his buy-in. Just because I mentioned that, you know, quite early in my decision to do this and got his buy-in. So I think for me, it's really like just dragging people into my vision.
That's okay.
since hepatitis was mentioned very briefly, we are engaged in a statewide strategy to eliminate viral hepatitis A, B, and C. And we have a briefing, informational briefing, coming up in the legislature, I think tomorrow. That's been years in the making. And it's, again, it's all about listening to the needs of the community, particularly our under-resourced, underserved community. And we have a Micronesian liver education program that has been in operation that, you know, provides information in appropriate languages. And doing that kind of outreach to people who have been marginalized by prevailing structures of political and economic power is really vital and life-saving work.
But thank you for sharing. One of the things I was going to ask you is, you talked about a little bit earlier, the state declaring racism as a public health crisis. And has that helped to facilitate other policy conversations, advocacy work, even related to the policy hearings around hepatitis A, B, and C?
I think that in the context of hepatitis, there is broad recognition in the health community and even in the policymaking community that this disproportionately impacts Asians and Pacific Islanders, particularly, you know, people from South Asia who come over, and that there's a need for increased education, increased vaccination, and for those with hepatitis C, linkage to curative treatment. We recently got our provider memo from MedQuest, which is our state Medicaid system, you know, removing some of that. In our opinion, all prior authorizations should be removed for those, you know, diagnosed with the hepatitis C virus. In terms of whether or not this state is doing a good job of thinking about race in the provision of public health and the impact on public health, the answer is, this is America. No. We like to put out these statements. It was a feel good thing. It's something I refer to because it was a nicely written resolution. But when push comes to shove, we're not willing to have a good extended conversation, for example, on the impact of the criminal legal system on our Native Hawaiian community or our Pacific Islander communities. We had a bail reform measure during the pandemic that got through the legislature, and it was pulled back at the last possible second because there's still so much fear-mongering around behavioral health issues and poverty. You know, the ACLU of Hawaii is taking the city and county of Honolulu to court to stop its homelessness sweeps. This is kind of the vital work that needs to be done, and challenging the exercise of power that really oppresses and worsens the situation for those with little to no economic means, and particularly those, you know, from our indigenous community.
You know, this morning I was scrolling through Facebook, and I came across one of our local pages called Stolen Stuff Hawaii, and there was a person in there who was critiquing the ACLU for coming after the state legislature's laws about sweeps, you know, basically criminalizing homelessness. And this person commented that we need these laws to protect our people. And I just thought to myself, like, people are so uneducated about these issues and yet so loud with their opinions, right? And that's, to me, that's the battle, right? We're fighting ignorance, and ignorance is really resistant. And so, like, when it comes to conversations about race in the broader context of healthcare or even policy, like, it's hard to have those conversations because people are uncomfortable having them. And when they're uncomfortable and they're ignorant at the same time, then you have just kind of like, you have a brick wall, and it's just, it doesn't really go anywhere. And so, like, what is the solution to that, right? Well, obviously funding schools, you know, I don't know what the bigger solution is. I don't have all the answers, but I know that it's really fighting those individual battles, especially in the age of social media, where people can share these opinions and garner support for, honestly, really stupid ideas.
If I could really interject just very briefly here, if you look at the state of our carceral facilities, for example, It's a public health nightmare and a human rights disaster, and it's been that way for a long time. COVID exacerbated that. It shed light on it. And here on Oahu, we're talking about building a new $1 billion jail facility without talking about any of the drivers of what keeps our jail population high, including, you know, the continuation of cash bail, including the lack of sentencing reform, including the lack of probation reform. There are just so many things that require more concerted attention that just gets kind of shunted aside. And we have a criminal legal lobby here, our police union, SHOPO, our prosecutors, especially this Honolulu prosecutor. He's on the warpath about cannabis right now. This is how out of touch, you know, our political structure is often in terms of just doing the necessary self-reflection as to whether or not they embody the aloha spirit that they like to wave about like some glittering toy. This is our people here. This is our community. Everybody here struggles with economic anxiety. Those with little no economic means struggle even more mightily. So I think, you know, it's incumbent for our policymakers and for even for our media folks to take a step back and consider whether or not they're listening to the whole story as to what's really going on in our communities.
So earlier you also mentioned, Nikos, a better regulatory framework. And what does that regulatory framework look like in terms of thinking about anti-racism and even if you want to be as specific as sort of thinking about, a framework that helps to address anti-Hawaiian, anti-Micronesian, all of the various, you know, populations within the state. What does that framework look like that embodies principles and practices of anti-racism?
I think I have to put, this is low-hanging fruit, but language access is kind of number one. And meeting people where they're at, that is a manifestation of that. We have big transportation issues here on this island and especially on our neighbor islands. So people need transportation assistance to get to medical appointments, if they can get the medical appointments, to the extent that we can use telehealth, particularly for our folks on the neighbor islands, and get those kinds of services online, then you also raise the technology gap issues too. Do we have an adequate system of broadband infrastructure to be able to facilitate those kinds of telehealth services? We need, you know, behavioral health treatment on demand. You know, it's a pipe dream. I know it's going to cost money, but ultimately that is the kind of thing that needs to happen. We cannot, you know, default to a situation where you have to have somebody in, you know, basically suicidal crisis to get access to needed medical services. I think our healthcare system and our correctional facilities are deficient, to say the least. And I think our Hawaii Correctional Oversight Commission will underscore that. There's so many things. I think in terms of, you know, what's called cultural competency, and maybe my colleagues can speak to this. We need systems of care that reflect, you know, Indigenous and Pacific Islander values, and meet the whole person. Because right now we're just, you know, a name and a number and an account, and that's just not the way to provide, you know, healthcare, particularly for, you know, under-resourced and dispossessed populations.
I think there's also something to be said of, you know, especially like from a Native perspective and Indigenous perspective, where do most of our people live? We live in areas that are outside of the city, more rural areas. And who has a lack of, whose communities have a lack of investment? It's these rural communities, right? And so when I think about healthcare access, and I think about where I grew up on the Big Island, which was an hour and 15 minutes away, just like straight driving from the nearest, like, not really urban spot, but bigger town. We didn't have access to a lot of things. And so we had to drive. And if we didn't have access to a car, then we were just kind of SOL, right? Recently, we just had our local HIV conference, and there was a really big discussion about transportation issues for rural communities. And someone had asked the question, well, what do you think the solution is? And then someone in the audience spoke up saying, the solution is to move closer to urban areas. And so I had to respond because as somebody who is Kanaka Maoli, where I grew up is special to me. That's my Aina Kupuna. That's where my family comes from. And I don't accept that moving away from that area is the right thing to do. But really, the question that people are trying to answer is, how do I bring my patients or people who need services to me? But the question we should be asking is, how do I bring my services and care to them? Because obviously the issue is transportation, right? If the issue is bringing them in, then why wouldn't we look at taking services out to them? And so, like, the whole harm reduction model, I think, has served our agency really well and the other ASOs in Hawaii really well, because we recognize that. And we recognize that the smaller communities, they don't need to come to us. We need to go to them. And finding ways to make that happen, I think that's really where the opportunity is.
So, I mean, I thank you so much for sharing all that you all have shared so far. And, you know, I really appreciate, you know, the candor and the openness with which you've shared all of this information. And then I really appreciate the framing of, you know, open hand, open heart, and open ears. And I think that it really helps to set the tone for and really describes and frames your approach to the work, the ways that you engage communities, and even the ways that you thought about policy changes and the intersections of how changes in some policies can really have a large effect for multiple populations and multiple groups, and really even highlighting some of the unique challenges that you all experience in Hawaii. Is there anything else you all want to share about approaches to policy change, systems change, or uplifting the voices of those who were most affected before we end?
I think our trans community under the leadership of Maddie and the Kuuana Project has done a really good job at visibility. And, you know, it's not done in isolation. It's not done alone. It's done with community, with the trans community, and with allies. This past session, earlier this year on Trans Day of Visibility, we had the biggest rally at the state capitol for the whole of the legislative session. I think there were almost 400 people there at a rally in support of trans rights. I think we do a very good job at kind of rallying the community for events like that. I think we need to do a better job at consistently speaking truth to power and being advocates for the communities that we serve. Maddie is the co-chair of our Sexual and Gender Minority Working Group, which is facilitated by our State Department of Health. And it's always continually looking at, you know, needed policy changes to benefit, you know, our sexual and gender minority communities here. And we've had a pretty good record of success, but more work needs to be done, especially when it comes to the provision of meaningful access to gender affirming care. You can have a policy, but the policy must be implemented for individuals who require it. Still so much work to do. And we really, you know, stand on the shoulders of those gay and lesbian activists who got the Ryan White Act passed into law. This did not come as an act of government beneficence. It came from activism, concerted activism for years. And we really stand, you know, on the shoulders of those men and women who made it happen back at a time when gay men were dying in droves. So, you know, the fierce urgency of now is a bit different, but it's still urgent.
Any recommendations for funders, people entering this space, who are new to this work, or even other folks that you want to make some recommendations?
I feel like it's including the service providers of those intended communities in the conversation of, like, objectives and deliverables. Because a lot of the things that are, like, created across the board aren't necessarily appropriate for all the communities that we work with. It might be appropriate for one or two, but the rest get left out. So I think it's for funders, it's really reaching out to service providers. And that's something that I found with our Kamehameha schools. They're a large education system, primarily for Native Hawaiians, that was left by one of our princesses in her will to educate Native Hawaiians. And they've reached out because they know that they cannot, they're good at educating children. They're not so good at educating the community or adults. So they've reached out to different community providers to get our input as to what we feel might affect change in the community. And I think more funders should follow that suit instead of having this like RFI created like within your own, you know, within a department of highly educated people that have no lived experience, and creating these deliverables that might not even be appropriate for the communities that they're intended for. So I think funders need to think more out of the box.
I think the only thing I would add to that is that, you know, our trans funding in recent years has been increasingly trust-based. And that means so much in terms of articulating, you know, what the work that we do and validating the work that we do, without putting too much, too many reporting requirements or getting too granular in terms of goals, objectives, and metrics. Because our transgender services program, you know, is working with people who have had long histories of various kinds of abuse, physical, sexual, and psychological, in addition to other trauma. You know, our trans community is disproportionately criminalized still. And so we need funders to consider the work that we are doing already and whether they can support that. And we're grateful to those organizations. You know, granted, there's a big pull for resources on the continent where trans people are really under attack. But yeah, that's the kind of philanthropy that we'd like to see more of, including for our service, some of our service contracts and support to help us, you know, bring adequate services to our under-resourced communities.
And you said trust-based? Did you say trust-based earlier?
Yes, trust-based philanthropy. So this goes down to, you know, the RFP and what's required on an application, in terms of articulation of work, and what the project is about. It basically centers on the trust that, you know, you're doing good work in the field already, and we're going to support that. We're not going to say, well, you get money if you do this, this, and this. If you're already doing it, great. That's trust-based philanthropy. And trust-based philanthropy also, you know, contemplates, you know, having reports done, say, you know, through a podcast or through a video, where people that are being served can provide testimony, and people providing the service can provide oral testimony and visuals. So I'm very aware that, and maybe Maddie can speak to this, that, you know, that asking for videos of you at work, some of the wonderful you know, Zooms that you had with our kupuna, that stuff speaks for itself. And I really think that needs to be supported and validated in that fashion.
Thank you, Nicholas. Yeah. You know, what is that? Yeah, one of our funders, it was amazing because they just wanted videos of clients and having them share their stories and how important it was for that, for our program. And it's beautiful because our clients always want to share, especially our elders. You know, our elders, they face the most discrimination out of all of us. You know, they had to wear a button that said they were a boy back in the 60s and 70s, you know, and they could not access health providers because of who they were. So, or not being addressed in the proper way, or, you know, just by their name or she, hers, you know. And so, because I know for me, I walked out of, you know, those healthcare providers, and that wasn't fair for our, especially our elders, because now they're facing so much health disparities. They're dying younger than most elders because of these health disparities. So, you know, by making sure everyone is aligned, you know, and we're able to provide these services, it really helps. And so making sure our funders understand that, you know, even though we're a small number, it makes a very big impact on our trans community. So,
you know, and I think in terms of, like, besides just funders, but even service providers, understanding that the communities that they serve have the solutions in the community, you know, and validating, like, cultural practices, you know, normal social things that one might go through. You know, we talked about, like, the Ke Ola Pono program, but also the way that we provide case management, to that population, right? And so it doesn't always look like, you know, somebody sitting in an office writing out an ISP and a service plan with that person and doing the typical reassessment. Sometimes it's just sitting, talking with them, you know, just kuka, you know, finding out about what's been going on in their life, you know? And when you talk about things like, oh, like their dog dying like a week ago, okay, that might explain why they haven't been engaged in services, you know? Or if they have been broke for like 2 weeks, okay, well, that explains why they haven't eaten. You know, that's like all of these things come to light when you just treat them like a person and you engage them in a way that's normal to them. You know, we so often focus on making people adapt to the services that we provide that we forget that, you know, they're people and we have to be malleable with the way that we provide that service. And so just also acknowledging too that there are, like, for among health providers, there are different concepts of medicine culturally. So, like, for Kanaka Maoli, we have la'au la'pa'au, you know, and not looking at that as an alternative medicine, but treating it like it's actually, like, that it's equal to what Western medicine can offer that person. Because if Western medicine has taught us anything, you know, the placebo effect is real, right? So, like, let's not pretend like all Western medicine is as effective as it says it is. But, you know, acknowledging that these things are equal and not placing them on a hierarchy, because that subliminally tells people that they're less than, and their beliefs, that their cultural practices, their traditions are not equal to what they've been subjected to. And so I think that's a really big message that comes out of the healthcare system a lot of times. And I would personally love to see service providers and healthcare providers acknowledge the cultural pieces of their patients, their communities, to really uplift them and to validate that existence. Recently, I was at a conference with Papa Ola Lokahi, and they had actually a friend of mine from high school. She is she's a neuro, I forget exactly what type of doctor it is. It's super fancy, but she used mo'okuauhau, or genealogy, to talk about predisposition to different genetic diseases, and it was fascinating because she merged these two concepts that were similar but very different, but infusing the cultural values of mo'okuauhau and how, like, different things like hanai affected that, and how, like, someone can look for that and talk about these things with families. And it kind of overwhelmed me a little bit, because I was like, you know, we finally have the chance to make our community heard in a way that they understand, you know, instead of trying to, like, translate all the medical jargon. So I have hope. That's just what I wanted to share.
Thank you. Thank you again. So last question. I appreciate all the time you spent with me today, chatting and helping our listeners to learn about, your work, the framing of your work, and, various aspects and programs and services that you all are providing, and just the approach in general to, you know, how we can help achieve health equity and take on principles and practices of anti-racism. And so, when you think about, you know, the entirety of your work, so far, and where you would like the work to go, what's the legacy that you would hope to be able to leave based on the body of work that you all have been actively involved in?
I think the legacy that I'd like to leave, both in my work here at H3RC and generally, is that I would like to, you know, inspire people, including people in government, whether they're service providers or policymakers, to continually take a step back and look inwardly and determine, you know, why they're doing what they're doing, and whether or not this is meeting kind of the manifestations of, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion in the larger world. When it comes to public health, we need an actual, you know, commitment to public health. And we also need a commitment to reducing, you know, the harms of the continued criminalization of behavioral health issues and the dispossession of our indigenous Hawaiian community and the suppression of our immigrant communities. And we all should always be looking to, you know, people who are the most underserved in our communities and continually reorienting and recalibrating our responses as a community to assist them. Just basic stuff.
For me, it's really going to be like giving cultural pride back to Native Hawaiians, having them be prideful of being Native Hawaiian. And along with that, and this is something that, like, I've seen, is that when you have that pride about yourself and a good sense of self-identity, you feel worthy enough to be well. You feel worthy enough to go to that provider to seek medical help, to seek support in general, that you feel worthy enough to access those things. And in my experience, a lot of the folks that I've worked with don't have that worthiness about themselves. And that's what I want to build and to cultivate.
I think I'm the same way as Kili'i. For a trans community, the legacy I just want to leave behind from our folks is that, you know, that to normalize it in all aspects, you know, to be comfortable in walking into a healthcare provider, to walking into seeing a psychiatrist, or to see any of those places where they're comfortable in their own skin, they're not being shunned. You know, my legacy is hopefully one day it's normal to be trans and we're accepted by everyone, and that we're not denied of any access to services for trans folk, and that, you know, we continue to build leaders, and hopefully the legacy continues on to making sure that trans folks are heard and being seen everywhere, and that it's normal and it's okay, because we have a place, like I said, in Hawaii in old times, we have a place. We know our kulana and our kuleana, which is our role and responsibility. So understanding that, that's the legacy I want to leave behind.
For me personally, so I'm really moved by the AIDS activism of the 1980s, you know, with ACT UP, really comes to mind. But like, to me, advocacy is so important, and to be able to speak up for myself and my community is very important. And I hope that the one thing that I impart on people is to not be afraid to speak up. I will never be afraid to speak up. I will open my mouth until it kills me, you know? But I really just want people to feel comfortable enough to voice what they need, because our people have been silent for way too long, and that silence has killed us. So I want us to speak up for ourselves, speak up for our communities, our neighbors, and the people who can't speak up for themselves.
Amen.
Amen to all of that. Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been just truly enriching in so many ways. And I want to thank you on behalf of the Institute for Healing Justice and Equity and the Critical Futures podcast for joining me today and spending so much time chatting and discussing the very important work that you all are are deeply committed to and involved in.
Thank you for listening to the Critical Futures Podcast. If you're feeling inspired and looking for more resources, please check out www.ihje.org/podcast for show notes and links to resources and to subscribe. Thanks for tuning in.